Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for tuning in, and welcome back. Today we're going to do the second part of our series on Einstein and quantum mechanics. Again, we have some great images for you posted on the website. Open a second window and go to guidetothecosmos.com. Click on the microphone icon to bring up a menu of radio shows and click on today's show, Einstein and Quantum Mechanics, Part 2. Last time we said that the two basic principles of quantum mechanics were quantization and particle-wave duality. Quantization merely means that in the micro world of molecules, atoms, and everything smaller, nature behaves more like a staircase at times than it does like a ramp, which is more characteristic of the macro world in which we live. So on a ramp, you can have any elevation you want just by positioning yourself in the right place, but on a staircase, you can only have the elevation corresponding to each of the stair steps. You can never be at an elevation that's between the second and third step because there's just no step there. Particle wave duality originated with Einstein and comes from the concept that light could be both a particle and a wave. This solved the photoelectric effect that we talked about in a prior radio show and led to de Broglie's extension that if light, which had always been thought of as a wave, could also be a particle, then particles, he reasoned, must also have wave characteristics, including a wavelength, which is determined by their momentum. The faster they go, the higher their energy, the shorter the wavelength. And we showed last time how this led to the conclusion that atoms were indeed stable because the electrons couldn't spiral into the nuclei because they were restricted to specific orbits whose circumferences were integral number of wavelengths. Then we talked about how you can make a wave packet by summing individual waves of different wavelengths and the trade-off that that imposes between the precision with which you know the position of the particle and the precision with which you know its energy or momentum. As one uncertainty gets smaller, inevitably the other uncertainty must increase. So quantum mechanics tells us that an electron orbiting around an atom, if undisturbed, fills its entire orbit simultaneously. It is everywhere in its orbit at the same time. And it's not possible to ask where the electron really is unless we make a direct measurement of it. So how is it that we could find out where the electron is? Well, first of all, how is it that we know where anything is? Think of something in the macro world. Let's say the moon. How do we know where the moon is? Well, light comes from the sun, it bounces off the surface of the moon, and some of that light is reflected toward the Earth, and we see it. So we know where the moon is because we observe particles that have interacted with it. In this case, light particles, photons, from the sun. So with that in mind, that we can only localize something by hitting it with a probe, how is it that we could go about trying to find out where an electron is in an atom? Well, we could start with probing the atom with photons, particles of light, and we have to choose what wavelength of light we're going to use. as you see in image number one. If we choose a photon with a large wavelength, that's a low energy, then if it bounces off the atom, we won't have any idea where the electron is except somewhere within the atom. So we really didn't learn much, because the wavelength of the light we used was so large that it encompassed the entire atom. So clearly, we need to use a smaller wavelength. Well, a smaller wavelength means a higher energy. And if we use a small enough wavelength to detect where the electron is, then we're going to have to hit that electron with the equivalent of a sledgehammer, a very high energy photon, a high energy probe. It could be any other particle, but the result is going to be the same. We're going to knock that electron right out of the atom, and we might know where it was when we hit it, but we're not going to know where it is thereafter. So it's really a catch-22. If we try to look at it gently, we won't see where it is, and if we try to look at it more aggressively, we'll destroy the information about where it was. So now let's talk about wave interference and one of the most important experiments in the history of quantum mechanics. Waves interfere, as shown in image number two on the wavesite, if they have the same frequency and if they have what we call a consistent phase shift. So what does that mean? If you look at image number two, on the left side, you see two sine waves that are oscillating in sync with each other. They have the same frequency, and they're both cresting and troughing at the same time. So the phase shift between those is zero, or one wavelength, or two wavelengths. Any of those describes the same situation. The waves crest and trough together because they arrive synchronously with each other. When you add two waves like that together, you get the result at the bottom left, which is a much larger wave. Makes sense. Now let's look at the right side of image number two. Here we have the waves arriving with a slight phase shift, so that one is cresting while the other is troughing, and the first one is troughing while the second is cresting. So these are shifted by half a wavelength. And because of that shift, the total of the two waves is always exactly zero. The waves completely cancel each other out because they are the exact opposites of each other at every point along the wave. This is something that certainly particles wouldn't do. If you combine two baseballs, you're not going to get zero baseballs, which is what we see on the right. If you combine two baseballs, you're not going to get four, which is actually what quantum mechanics tells us results from the lower left. So in quantum mechanics, it's possible to add two waves together and end up with anywhere between zero and four as the result. Now, image number three on the website shows the most famous experiment in the history of quantum mechanics, which is the two-slit experiment. The two-slit experiment consists of a source of particles. Let's start with a source of photons, the particles of light, and a barrier that has two holes in it. These are the two slits. And each of the slits has a door that we can either open or close that allows the particles to either pass through the barrier or be stopped by the closed door. And at the top, after the particles have gone through the barrier, they hit a detector plane, which could be something like a piece of film. So the detector will keep track of where the particles hit at the upper surface. Now on the left, we see what would happen if only the left door was open. We would have some sort of a broad distribution on the film on the left side. On the right side of the image, we see what would happen if only the right door was open. Again, there would be some sort of a broad distribution on the right side. In the center of the image, we see what happens when both doors are open. The waves of light, carried by the photons, go through both slits at the same time, since that they have the same distance between the barrier slits and the source. and they arrive at the detector, and the wave from the left door and the wave from the right door will interfere with each other at the detector plane. So we're going to get something corresponding to the previous slide, where we got anywhere between 0 and 4 times the total energy. Well, in the very center of the detector, in the middle of the image here, we see that it's equally distant to the two slits, and so the waves are going to arrive after traveling the same distance from the left slit and the right slit, and they're going to be exactly synchronized, peaking and troughing at the same time, and so they will add constructive interference, and we're going to get a maximum intensity right in the middle. If we move slightly off center, let's say to the left, then we will eventually get to a point where the distance to the left slit and the distance to the right slit are different enough that the waves arriving at the detector will be out of sync by exactly half a wavelength. In other words, we'll have the situation we had on the right side of figure 2, and one wave will peak while the other troughs, and they will exactly cancel each other out, and at this point on the detector, the wave energy will be zero. This is actually a remarkable phenomenon, if you think about it. This is a place on the detector where, with both doors open, zero energy arrives. This is a place on the detector where light could reach if only the left door was open. And this is a place where light could reach if only the right door was open. But this place cannot be reached if both doors are open. If light has two ways to get there, it can't get there at all. Very different than what we would expect with baseballs. And if we move further to the left, we're going to get back to a situation where the path lengths are so different that they differ by a whole wavelength. So once again, both waves will crest and trough at the same time, and we'll get a maximum. Even further to the left, we'll get to a situation where the difference again is half a wavelength. And so we will alternate between the peaks and the troughs across the detector surface, and these are called interference fringes, a trademark signature of wave behavior. However, it has been discovered that particles do exactly the same thing. And we see that on image number 4 on the website, where we have the same two-slit experiment done with electrons instead of photons. This is a very much more difficult experiment. It was done with such a low intensity of electrons that only one electron passed through the system at a time. And on the right side of image number 4, we see the characteristic interference fringes of wave behavior by the electrons. The image on the right was taken with 140,000 electrons, and this compares with the image on the left, which was taken with only 200 electrons. If you look carefully at the image on the left, you'll see it's made of a number of discrete small spots. In other words, each electron actually hits the detector in only a single spot. In other words, it acts like a particle. An ocean wave crashing on the shore doesn't hit a single grain of sand, it hits the whole beach, right? But a particle will hit a single spot. So here we see on the left proof that the electron is a particle, yet on the right is proof that the electron is also a wave, just as Einstein and de Broglie had predicted. And because the intensity of these electrons is so low that there's only one in the system at a time, we are left with the inescapable yet startling conclusion that each of these electrons has gone through both slits simultaneously, so that its wave came from both slits, arrived at the detector with various phase shifts, and created the interference pattern that we see. if each of the electrons had gone through only one slit, then we would have two spots on the detector, two fuzzy spots, and not the interference fringes that we see. This is one of the most dramatic experiments which emphasizes the principal predictions of quantum mechanics. And Richard Feynman, one of my professors at Caltech, said that the two-slit experiment encapsulates all of the weirdness of quantum mechanics. And if you can wrap your head around this, you can handle anything quantum mechanics has to throw at you. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's guidetothecosmos.com.
We're back. This is Guide to the Cosmos with your host, Robert Piccioni, and we're talking today about Einstein and quantum mechanics. This is part two of our show. Now let's talk about a famous but much maligned feline, Schrödinger's cat. But first I want to emphasize to everyone that this politically incorrect thought experiment that we're going to describe was never actually performed on a living cat. It was only a thought experiment. No actual cats were ever injured because of this bizarre suggestion of Schrödinger. Here we see, in image number 5 on the website, a picture of a cat in a sealed box. And in the box with the cat is a radioactive source, a detector for radiation, and a bottle of poison gas. The arrangement is that the radioactive source is going to decay at some time, which is completely unpredictable according to the laws of quantum mechanics, but the probability of the decay at any given moment is completely predictable. We can predict what the probability will be after a certain amount of time, but we have no idea when it's actually going to occur. Well, so this arrangement is, if the source decays, the poison gas will be released. And we will wait until the probability of a decay is 50%, and then ask the question, what is the current state of the cat? Is the cat alive? Is it dead? Or is it both? Both, you say. How crazy is that? Who in their right mind would say both, alive and dead? Well, the answer is all of the proponents of quantum mechanics, led by their champion, Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr would say that the cat is in a superposition of two states, alive and dead. And until we open the box and take a look, the cat persists in this uncertain midway situation. He would add that nothing exists until it is measured. Einstein would respond, that's completely crazy. First of all, the cat either has to be alive or dead, and certainly can't be both. And beyond that, Whether the cat is alive or dead can't have anything to do with whether we happen to observe him or not. Einstein would say that there is a reality which is beyond the mere measurement of physicists. Now, if the cat was an elementary particle, which is completely dominated by the rules of quantum mechanics, then Bohr would indeed be correct. It would be in a state of a combination of alive and dead. That has been proven time and time again with detailed, precise experiments. But a cat is not an elementary particle. There are probably 10 to the 28 particles in the cat, the air, and the box. That would be 10,000 trillion trillion. And all of these particles are interacting with each other continuously. So those interactions will disturb the coherence that's necessary for quantum interference. In other words, the waves will be disturbed and they will no longer be synchronized, the alive wave and the dead wave. And without coherence, there can be no interference. This destruction of the coherent effect will happen in certainly less than a millionth of a second. And so the fate of the cat at any moment in time actually will be well determined, as we would expect in the macroscopic world. Another bizarre consequence of the uncertainty principle of quantum mechanics is a phenomenon known as virtual particles. And this is of tremendous importance in physics, and in fact, it may be one of the factors that is controlling the fate of the universe. Now, in the good old days, we used to think that the vacuum, empty space, was, well, empty, that there was nothing to it at all. It was the absence of anything else. But quantum mechanics, with its uncertainty principle, tells us that even in completely empty space, particles can spontaneously appear, live an infinitesimal period of time, and then recombine and disappear back into complete nothingness. These particles are called virtual particles. And how can they exist? Well, because Heisenberg has told us that the degree to which we can measure the energy of a system, the uncertainty in that measurement, cannot be arbitrarily small. The uncertainty in the energy measurement multiplied by the uncertainty in time at which the energy measurement is valid must always be greater than some minimum quantity. We can't drive one uncertainty down without the other uncertainty increasing correspondingly. So it follows that we can never be sure that energy is conserved with absolute precision for an absolutely infinitesimal period of time. And so indeed, energy conservation could be violated by a very small amount for a very brief period, and that violation would never be measurable because the uncertainty principle wouldn't allow it. Quantum mechanics takes one more step in making this even more bizarre by saying that if something is not completely forbidden in nature, then it is in fact required. So the requirement is that these virtual particles appear, live an infinitesimal period of time, and then recombine and disappear. And the only constraint is that the amount of energy that they borrow from the bank of Heisenberg times the duration of the loan has to be very, very brief indeed. An electron and an anti-electron can appear from the vacuum and stick around for a few trillionths of a trillionth of a second, and then they need to disappear and repay the loan. It's not just electrons and anti-electrons that appear, it's any particle and it's antiparticle. And they appear everywhere and always, throughout empty space and throughout space that's not empty. This process sounds very bizarre. Sounds like something a couple of physicists might have dreamed up after way too many happy hours. But indeed, the predictions of virtual particles are absolutely precisely confirmed. It is a well-established physical principle that virtual particles truly do exist. And even during their brief existence, they can affect the behavior of normal particles, and that effect needs to be taken into consideration if the predictions of quantum mechanics are going to match nature, which indeed they do, to 12 decimal digits. At the bottom left of image number 6 is the predicted value of G, the gyromagnetic ratio of the electron, and it's listed out to 12 decimal digits, and the experimental evidence matches that prediction to plus or minus 2 in the last decimal digit, the 12th decimal digit, to one part in a trillion. If virtual particles did not exist, G would be exactly 2.000 all the way out to infinity. But the virtual particles change the value of G by the amount shown, and that amount exactly matches what we observe in nature. Another consequence of the uncertainty principle is a phenomenon known as barrier penetration. Another one of these very interesting things that only quantum mechanics would allow. Yet, another thing that is exactly confirmed by observations of nature. In the micro world, particles can penetrate a barrier even if, for example, they don't have enough energy to climb over the barrier. It is as if we were rolling a bowling ball against a concrete wall and suddenly we find that the bowling ball appears on the opposite side of the wall, without even making a hole in the wall to pass through. It is on our side of the wall, and then it might be on the opposite side of the wall. Two examples of this barrier penetration phenomenon are shown in image number 7 on the website. On the left, we see a cup holding superfluid helium-4. And below that is a diagram which shows the energy barrier in green and the wave of the helium-4 particles in black. On the left, we have the helium-4 particles that are captured within the cup, and there is a high amplitude wave indicating that there's a high probability of the particles being there. They don't have the proper amount of energy to leap up over the edge of the cup, so we see that there is a barrier there which is higher than the amplitude of the wave, which represents the energy needed to rise to the top of the lip. Yet, because of quantum mechanics and the uncertainty principle, the wave of the particles does not immediately drop to zero when it gets to the barrier, but rather exponentially decreases through the barrier. And if it hasn't dropped all the way to zero, and actually an exponential never does drop all the way to zero, there will be a very small residual probability for the wave to be outside the cup. Of course, if the particle appears outside the cup, it will roll down to the bottom of the cup as shown. You see that drop at the bottom of the cup, and then drip onto the surface below. So there is a very small residual probability as seen on the right, and sooner or later, each of those particles within the cup is going to find itself outside the cup and drop to the bottom. On the right side of the same image, we see the phenomenon of radioactive decay. Protons and neutrons in a nucleus have the same sort of energy levels that electrons do in an atom. These are discrete, separated energy levels in which the protons and neutrons are allowed to be. They can't have any old energy. They have to have the energy corresponding to a specific step. Referring back to what we said at the beginning, in the microworld, there are steps, not ramps. And we see here the wave of one of the particles at the top energy level, waving very strongly inside the nucleus with an exponential decrease through the barrier that keeps the nucleons within the nucleus. So there's a strong nuclear force that binds those nucleons together. That creates a barrier, and there is some chance that one of these particles could leak through that barrier because, again, of the uncertainty principle and appear on the other side. And if it does, then the nucleus has lost the particle, and we call that radioactive decay. So I hope you enjoyed our tour through the bizarre world of quantum mechanics, a world which is vastly different from the world we experience in everyday life, but a world that is equally as real. Quantum mechanics is a theory that has been tested over 100,000 times with absolutely superb precision. And we know that these strange phenomena are exactly as we have described. Even the strangest science fiction doesn't hold a candle to the realities of quantum mechanics. Thank you for tuning in. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.